This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
Right now, it seems like so much of what's out there is just medical. Like, we can take your blood pressure. We have a pillbox that'll talk to you. I don't think that's what most older people are looking for in technology. They're looking for their lives to be supported and enriched. And we're right at the cusp of that.
Hello and welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. We call it LAMA for short. I'm Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. Well, this is another episode from TEDMED, the annual conference focusing on health and medicine. TEDMED has a new partner, the SCAN Foundation, which focuses on issues relating to healthcare and independent living for older adults. Well, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Bruce Chernoff, who is SCAN's president and chief executive officer. Bruce, welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Good to see you. You've just launched your own podcast, haven't you?
Yes. We have a lot to learn from you.
Well, hopefully it's mutual. When I Am Older, it's called.
When I Am Older, that's right.
And what sort of things will you focus on?
We think that there's a real need to change the dialogue on what it means to age. And particularly here in the United States, aging is somehow somebody else's business. But in reality, it's something that we're all doing. And our own work has shown us very clearly that the kind of classic shorthands to describe what it means to be a caregiver, often an older woman caring for an aging or sometimes failing husband, while that is one form of caregiving, certainly, or one example of caregiving, the reality is that caregiving is far more multi-generational, that millennials and Gen Xers in the United States are active caregivers, even if they don't use that word. A third of millennials are active caregivers today, and another third expect to be caregivers in the next 5 years, and they feel incredibly stressed out about it. And so for us, launching the podcast was an opportunity to recognize that caregiving is multi-generational, that changing the discussion from about somebody, something over there to something and somebody who is us and what we're doing was incredibly important. And like your podcast, trying to bring some science and knowledge and understanding, we think is incredibly important to changing the conversation here in this country.
Well, one of the things I try to do, and I think it's in your mind from what you've said, and that is try to bring a message about longevity and aging to younger generations, perhaps before people generally tend to think about these issues, which might be in their 40s or 50s, perhaps they're beginning to go grey or their parents are entering the next stage in terms of aging. But to age well, to my mind, we need to think about this really early and start in our 20s and 30s. And I know that's a generation that often doesn't want to think about aging because we're going to live forever when we're in our 20s. And of course, we grow older and we realize that that's not true. But sometimes I think the message needs to be brought to those younger generations for the benefit of everyone.
Peter, that's spot on. That is exactly right. And that is really at the heart of why we've launched this podcast. Because not only is it owning a reality that we will all face someday, but not owning it today has incredibly important implications for millennials and Gen Xers. The idea that somehow caregiving is this unidimensional discussion about, well, when I get older, I'll have these needs and maybe my spouse will have these needs and I wonder how we'll get them taken care of. But right now I have all these other things to do and be, and I'll worry about it when I get there, is incredibly problematic because the reality is that millennials and Gen Xers, as they're trying to build their lives, start their lives, build professional lives, get married, have kids, be members of church and community, all the things that we do in our lives, caregiving becomes one of those things. It's about a multidimensional life. And the reality is that most millennials and Gen Xers will care for somebody in some way in their family. And so the interaction between their caregiving role and all the other roles they have in their life are incredibly important. And by engaging in those roles now, they're actually helping design their own future.
And caregiving is a very broad phrase, of course, isn't it? There are many extensions to the concept of caregiving. As you imply, it could be caring for a spouse, it could be caring for a friend, it can be caring for a parent, it can be caring for another blood relative. Who knows what the scenario is going to be? And to an extent, caring for yourself as well while you're doing the caring.
Again, I think it's such a well thought through observation, Peter, because the reality here is caregiving is not just in the nuclear family. I myself look after an adopted grandmother who's 102, about to be 103, and she still lives in the home that she and her husband bought in the 1950s, and she's still determined every day to climb the stairs in her home to sleep in the bedroom that they slept in all those years when he was still alive. And you know, if you were to look at that house, you'd say, well, this is a geriatrician's nightmare. You know, it's all carpet and extension cords and whatnot. And she wouldn't have her life any other way. And so one of the dimensions of my life is to help nurture that energy that she has and the joy that she has. And this isn't somebody who's a blood relative. And so to your point, I think it's about being of service in a larger sense. Could be family, could be more. And then I think this idea that caregiving is not a great word. Maybe you and I will dream up a better word, but it's very clear to me and in the foundation's work that that's not a great way to engage younger generations. They do it because they love their grandmother. Or mom and dad said, you know, we're going to do X and Y and Z on Monday, Wednesday, Friday for, you know, your sick aunt who lives down the street, but we kind of need your help on Tuesdays because we work those nights. And so I think building a better vocabulary is something we both ought to lock arms and try to do.
I tend to agree with you. And it does, it shouldn't have, but it does for some people, I think, have negative connotations. It's something, it's a spell in their lives that perhaps they want to delay or not think about because they think it's about just doing some of those practical things that younger people feel as if they are not equipped to do or maybe don't want to do when they get older. But then I think attitudes change. You said something about living to a 102 and being in your own house, which I think we can all applaud to a point. But then the challenge for a lot of caregivers is to persuade that person that it really isn't a good idea. Older people want to cling on to being in their own home because they love it, they cherish it, they feel safe and comfortable there, and it's got memories. But it really isn't safe anymore. So is that a challenge that you face in the people that you deal with, that there comes a point when caregiving involves tough love for the people that are being cared for?
So I think one of the challenges we all face in our lives is the unknown. And one of the best tinctures for the unknown is certainty. And one of the challenges then with aging is that we confront circumstances, some of which we can expect and plan for, but many of which we can't, that start to rob us of certain kinds of certainties. And the unknown then becomes even more of a challenge. And I think that the example you describe is probably the most powerful one. But, you know, stopping driving, particularly here in the United States, is a real issue. You know, the loss of key activities, things, even something as simple as being able to participate in church or temple on a regular basis just because you're not able to do that. Those losses are really, really important. Housing is the most prevalent one. You know, for me, I think the solve is to help manage that uncertainty. And so I've come in my own work as a doctor, not necessarily just about the work of the foundation, to realize that what's hardest about moving, it's as much about not really understanding and feeling very uncomfortable about where they might end up, as much as it is about giving up what they have.
And I think it's the giving up of the independence.
Yeah.
That just preys on people's minds. That,
it does.
That this is almost the end or the beginning of the end because they can't jump in that car, go somewhere, and then return to their own home like they always have.
And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
But I think creating, so trying to take some of that uncertainty out of it, creating opportunities to lessen that uncertainty is I think, really important. So one of the things that I love best out of some work I was involved in, the WHO has done a lot of work around aging. And at one of their conferences, one of the folks who spoke at it focused on driving. This was work that was done in England or on the continent. But the kind of the take-home lesson was helping every older person have a plan to manage their mobility, to maximize their mobility 5 years before they'll need to stop driving is really important. So for example, helping older adults now have built-in systems that they're comfortable using to help them get around.
And presumably it's also about encouraging older adults in maybe the final home but one, certainly the last couple of places they live, if they're the kind of typical family that moves around every 15 or 20 years, that those places are accessible. And perhaps in the modern world, when we should all be relying on public transport more for environmental reasons and all sorts of other factors, that that aspect of their lives comes earlier than traditionally that we've allowed ourselves to be less dependent on roads and infrastructure.
My point exactly. So if you take somebody who's so used to driving and suddenly say, you can't drive anymore, you have to take a bus or call a taxi or maybe learn how to use Uber, and you have an older person who, say, is not going to be comfortable mucking around with an app on their phone, the time to build a plan that they're comfortable with. Like, let's talk about all the places you want to go and all the ways that you might get there. And let's trial run these things. I'll go with you. So there are ride-hailing solutions for older adults now that don't actually require an app. So GoGo Grandparent, for example, is completely operationalized through that piece of modern technology, the landline telephone.
I know Lyft are doing some quite
good. Lyft is doing very similar things. Yeah. And so I think by letting people trial solutions in advance of needing them and building confidence is incredibly important. Waiting till it's not safer, there's a problem, is an issue. And I think the same thing can be said for housing. And so your observation, I think, is spot on. You know, if folks are intentionally thinking about moving to an environment that they think that they're going to live in for the rest of their lives, universal design is really important. You know, buying a loft that's three, you know, like a shoebox on end, that's three stories tall with a bunch of spiral staircases is likely a poor solution as you age. And I think, you know, we have many kinds of supported living communities, all kinds of assisted living and other sorts of environments. Those environments, you know, they tend to feel a little bit like Renaissance walled city states. And what I mean by that is, you know, they turn their backs to the community and their faces to those that they serve. But really what they ought to be doing is inviting people into the community to really get a feel for what it's like to maybe have just a little bit more support, but a space that's your own. And yes, you can bring all those treasures that you and your spouse collected that have great meaning, that, you know, that color your life and help, you know, kind of fill out the details of important memories. So I think your point about creating opportunities to be a bit more planful in a positive way is very important.
Yeah, and I think to the extent that you mentioned, look, I will go with you to the train station. I will go with you to the places that you need to go. I think, actually, we probably need to be thinking about it at the stage before that, where you can take yourself and take the initiative. While you still can, take the initiative and figure it out. I mean, I certainly want to figure it out for myself in terms of what kind of lifestyle I'm going to have as I get older at different points in my life, if I can, possibly. And that's, I'm maybe super aware of it because of what I do. But wouldn't it be great if you could just initially take that initiative at the age of 50 or 55 and say, look, I'm getting up there. I'm going to be 60. I'm going to be 70. Let's figure it out for myself.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think the reality is that if we were doing this, say, as social scientists or human-centered designers, for example, and we were thinking about this as a sort of product or services exercise, the reality is that there's different archetypes of people. And I think one of the things you and I both share, it's clear to me from this conversation, is that we're both sort of naturally planners. And so for folks like us, that makes total sense. And, you know, a little bit of encouragement or nudging to, you know, be planful at 50 so you're, you know, you are better prepared at 60, better prepared at 70, 80, and 90. Makes perfect sense, right? We'd sign up for that. There are going to be subset of folks who just aren't quite as planful as you and I are. And so creating opportunities to help them as well. The, you know, the sort of the buddy system, let's do, and that could be a grandchild. This could be a child. It could be a neighbor, but let's make a bus run, or let's call Uber and see what happens, and let's do it together.
And I think in parallel with these decisions that need to be made about aging, life generally is changing for all of us. And I think there may well come a point where it isn't necessarily the norm to own a car. And you might well get used to, especially if you're living in a city, just not owning a car. And many young people don't own cars because they will take public transport, they will use Uber or whatever's the most economic. And I think so lifestyles are going to change as well. So there's always going to be a new challenge. But I think some of the challenges may well go away, or just through the natural transition of things, that we won't necessarily be dependent on some of the things that we are now in the future.
I think that that's definitely true. And as your listeners hear us chatting today, one of the challenges I would put in front of all of them is, I worry a lot that things like the Internet of Things and smart devices, they have the opportunity to really enhance and improve people's lives. And we're getting to a point where certain kinds of technology, you know, kind of house assistant, Alexa style support, could be incredibly powerful in helping keep older people engaged, needs met, actually foster independence and also foster connectivity. All these things cost something. And the reality is that a smart fridge will be incrementally more expensive than a not smart fridge. And these technologies have the opportunity, I think, to really enhance the lives of older people who generally live on a fixed income. And that opportunity for, you know, makers of these equipment to build new products and enhance margin, that's great. But we're going to have to figure out how to get these in the hands of everybody. And I think your point about technology and driving is really important. We'll get to a point where owning a car will make no sense, that we will all have an autonomous ride-hailing service that serves our community. And, you know, you call the voice assistant and say, I need a car to go to the supermarket, and magically it appears. And we're all comfortable with that. It's not here today, but it's not that far away yet. So I can imagine really wonderful things for aging and what technology can do, moving away from this kind of, right now it seems like so much of what's out there is just medical. Like, we can take your blood pressure. We have a pill box that'll talk to you. I don't think that's what most older people are looking for in technology. They're looking for their lives to be supported and enriched. And we're right at the cusp of that, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think we are. And I think it is actually quite exciting. And I think it's a reason to be positive. There are many reasons to be nervous about the way that we are going in society in terms of caring for older people. But I think technology gives us scope to be positive, that some really interesting things are happening. And we are growing older with the technology. And I think that's crucially important, that we at a younger age begin to understand and feel comfortable with the kind of technology that will help us in whether it's 10 or 30 years time.
That's absolutely right. And I'm very sensitive to the fact that I'm in the sort of digital immigrant generation. So there weren't smartphones when I was a 10 or 12 year old.
Me too. We didn't have phones at all when we were 10 years old.
so I realized that even some of my own, I'm very sensitive that I'm my own sort of N of one in our work in a way. And you realize that even folks one generation younger than you and I are far more savvy with technology. And your point is exactly right that, you know, as each generation has a different engagement with technology, and that the evolution of those generations over time as the technology evolves is going to really drive the adoption curve. There are going to be places where there's going to be mismatches between the adoption curve and the value of certain kinds of technology. And I think those of us who are interested in successful aging are going to have to be very mindful of those. So the example of an autonomous ride-hailing service could be fabulous, but if no older person trusts it because they're nervous about it because you can't drive it and it has no steering wheel, that's a problem. So how do we deal with that adoption curve challenge? But on balance, I think we're going to see much richer, more connected, and more supported lives than, say, the generation just before us.
I agree. I started by giving a brief summary of what SCAN does, and you've covered that as well. But could you maybe just give me a wider idea of what the organization does and perhaps also your partnership with TEDMED?
Absolutely. So the foundation is fundamentally focused on transforming care for older adults and their families and communities, and that we ultimately believe every older person should live with independence, dignity, and choice. And so our work always takes us back to the person and their family and their circle of support, and what does that look like. We tend to work in three very specific, albeit large, areas. We are very interested in how we transform the behavior of large health systems to be more person-centered, which means thinking about care that's more goal-oriented and more community-based as opposed to sort of hospital-based. We do an enormous amount of work around public policy, both at the state and federal level, because there are barriers in this country to how we use resources. We use resources very inefficiently. Compared to other industrialized countries, we spend so much more money on the acute care system and so much less money on the home and community-based side of things. And we get very little value for that disparity. And so changing public policy to allow more flexibility in spending is really important. And then finally, we do a lot of work looking at how to build resilience and capacity for individuals, their families, and communities. And we think that's really important because we know that older adults and their families spend an enormous amount of money on products and services and programs that they don't really expect the healthcare system to do for them. This is about how they live their lives as people, not how they live their lives as patients. And so much of our design work falls in that area. With respect to TEDMED, we're very pleased to be here, because given this year's theme of chaos and clarity and the diversity of speakers, we've also launched a millennial campaign called Do You Give a Care? Because we realize that community is one of the things that's most important to millennials and Gen Xers. And we think this idea of moving the discussion from it's an older person's discussion to it's a multi-generational discussion. And for millennials and Gen Xers, this gets at how they launch their professional lives, how they build their families. And to not manage the caregiving challenge has economic implications, not just personal implications in their lives. We want them to help own their future by helping drive the future of their parents and grandparents.
I think that's a really good way to think about it, because I think we have to have this multi-generational approach to aging and to dealing with aging. And I think by specifically looking at those younger generations, you can, I think, educate people in a meaningful way. Perhaps there's the will there. It's just societal attitudes are different, I think, when you're younger. And I think it's just a matter of bringing everyone together and getting everyone on the same page to go on this journey together, which is ultimately what it's all about. And the other thing I noticed, just on a similar theme, is the number of organizations that are deliberately bringing generations together. And I'm thinking of universities in dorms and residences, which to me is the best way to do it, because you've got two generations here that are gaining in so many ways from just being together. And it's shared knowledge, but it's a shared wisdom and shared practical know-how to get through life.
I can't begin to tell you how strongly I agree with that, Peter. And I think one of the things that makes me so hopeful about this work and really leads me to believe that the timing is perfect is So millennials get tagged with, you know, all the sort of shorthand slang that, you know, this is the Me Too generation and they couldn't be more selfish and they've got their nose glued to their phone. This is also the generation that has really birthed the sharing economy, that is less obsessed with what I own and more about how I engage and how do I create experiences that are meaningful. And there's a sense of community that I think has been lacking for a couple of generations that is much more prevalent in the kind of underlying sort of mores and cultures of millennials and Gen Xers as well. And so in a funny way, I think that they're helping design the future that we should all want, regardless of what generation we're in. And that's why we think this campaign is really important, because it flies exactly in the face of poorly thought through and easily thrown out stereotypes.
Let me ask you, you are a medical doctor. I'm curious, with your medical doctor hat on, what you think the health challenges are as we move forward and as people age. What should we be looking at?
So I think for me, clinically, you know, a couple of things are true. We tend to live with a medical model which would be perfectly fine if we were all living in the silent generation. So the idea that if you look at when Medicare and Medicaid were created in 1965, the average life expectancy in the United States was 69. And if you look at the top, say, 10 causes of death, the majority of them, probably two-thirds of them, were in essence acute illnesses, or you might linger slightly after something like a heart attack or stroke, but there wasn't nearly as much available, nearly as much that one could do. And so now we have a life expectancy in the United States, you know, pushing 80, higher for some groups, slightly lower for others. And the reality is we're all likely to live longer, but we are going to live with more chronic illness. If you look at the top 10 causes of death today, they're almost all chronic. And it's not just the illness themselves, but it's the functional needs that get created over time. So chasing diseases is not going to get us there. It is disease plus function. So the fact that you're diabetic is an issue. But the fact that you've lost sensation in your fingers and toes and are much more likely to fall may actually be way more important than the diabetes itself, or that you've had visual loss from the diabetes and that your seeing is not as good. And again, fall risk, all kinds of things. So I think clinically for me, one really important thing is this idea that we need a model that recognizes that we're all likely to need a little bit of help as we age. Probably half of Americans who are 65 today will actually reach a quote-unquote nursing home level of care. They'll have needs that are that great, but they'll never live in a nursing home. So what does that model look like? You know, we have a healthcare delivery system that's sort of purpose-built for about 1972, and we're going to need to demand that it operate in a way that recognizes that people with needs live at home. And that's home, not necessarily the home where you raised your kids, but in the community, in ways that they choose to live. And so I think that change in clinical thinking is going to be incredibly important. The other thing that I would say that fascinates me is the things that seem like the most inscrutable problems this very moment could change at the snap of a finger. So for example, you know, dementing illnesses, Alzheimer's in particular, is a profound challenge in families, in communities, as a public health concern. But I think back on my life as a young doctor, just as the AIDS crisis was happening. I'm a general internist by training. And, you know, when the crisis began, there were no treatments. There were no treatments. It was a death sentence. And first there was AZT, and then we had highly active retroviral therapy. And now it's a chronic illness that people live with. And so, as we think about Alzheimer's and planning for Alzheimer's, I think we need to plan for people who have needs and memory loss. But sooner or later, you know, whether it's 5 years from now or 7 years from now, we'll have a first major treatment that probably radically doesn't prevent the disease, doesn't cure it, but probably radically slows it. And at some point, you know, and maybe it's a decade from now, nobody knows, it may be a disease that we can manage very aggressively, because we'll know something about the amyloid problems and how they get produced and how to stop them. So I'm very mindful that we plan for the future that exists in front of us today, but are also mindful that it could look really different in 5 years. If you and I have the same discussion 5 years from now, we may see a different, completely different set of problems.
Yeah, and I think that's almost a certainty, that if we did have this conversation in 5 years' time, the world will look different. I think these big issues, these big problems, dementia, different kinds of dementia, obviously they're still going to exist, but we will hopefully have made some progress, and that'll put pose a completely different picture in terms of how we deal with these things. And things are going to continually progress in that respect, and hopefully progress positively. I'm curious and you said you're a planner, as you look ahead in your own life, and I'm guessing we're probably about the same age.
16, right?
Well, I was going to say 21.
Okay.
I'll give you that, yeah. Okay. what have you learned and what do you continuously learn from your work that you apply to yourself? Something that perhaps you've worked on as a medical doctor or in terms of your current work that you apply to yourself with your own longevity in mind?
So I think for me, one of the most important things about this work, one is a very humble observation that I've come to realize about myself from my years as a practicing doctor and a healthcare administrator and now running a foundation. And as I look at my adopted 102-year-old grandmother, that we all harbor in our own way various kinds of ageist thinking, and sort of breaking that out is really important. And I'm very mindful now that I can still feel my, very distinctly, my 20-year-old self and my 30-year-old self, and that I've grown in many ways, and hopefully I'm just a little bit smarter than I was back then. But that richness is still very much part of my life. And as I look at my 102-year-old adopted grandmother, it is seriously part of her life, given the many more decades she has on me. And that, you know, I think sometimes we don't recognize that there's just this incredible wealth of knowledge and experience in older people. And so one of the things I'm always catching myself on, right, is sort of recognizing that this sort of great font of knowledge and being very respectful of it. And realizing that in every 102-year-old, there's a 20-year-old.
There is. And in every 50-year-old, there's a 15-year-old. And yeah, I think we never lose that connection with our youth, do we?
No, we don't. And I think really embracing that and talking about it is really important. When my adopted grandmother had her 102nd birthday, we took her to a fancy restaurant in the Arts District in downtown Los Angeles. And it's a restaurant that largely caters to a much younger crowd. And we had this nice young waiter come up and take our order and was very kind of sweet and kind to her. And she's got kind of an arch sense of humor, and the waiter was completely into that. And she looked up at me and she said, "You know, he's cute." I'm like, okay. So there's the 20-year-old inside the 102-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I just think that sort of embracing that and recognizing it is really important. I think the most important hard lesson that I've learned from this, that's my fun lesson, is that having a plan and sharing it with others is really important. We may not, as we get older, be able to increase the amount of economic resources we have around us, but you can build other kinds of resources, community, family, things that we've been talking about, like what are alternate sources of transportation? If I needed to live in a more supported environment, what would I look like? What would that look like? How would I get there? And so I think the thing that I've tried to build into my own life and encourage others to do, walk the talk, is to do that kind of planning and see it as a joyous thing. Part of this is the multi-generational piece. So having the opportunity to have young people in your life and mentoring them is really important. And no, they may not be, you know, your primary caregiver as you age, but they're part of your life and they're there for you. So for me, I think that that's one of the most important things we can all do to age with dignity, choice, and independence is to have a plan and to argue for, you know, these are my choices, and to be able to argue for what we think dignity looks like, and to have a circle of folks around us, whether they're blood relatives, extended family, or family that we've chosen to be there to help us realize it.
Bruce, what's the best way for people, if they want to follow your work, to get in touch, your website, social media? What's the best way for people to watch what you're doing?
Absolutely. So the foundation's work can all be found on our, that old-fashioned thing, a website. So the SCAN Foundation, if you were to Google it, will pop right up, scanfoundation.org.
Yeah, I did that, and it's a very comprehensive website, so there's a lot of information on there.
We do a fair amount of social media work, so you can follow us on Twitter. Our campaign, Looking to Transform Aging Here in California, We Stand With Seniors, our caregiver campaign, Do You Give a Care, all have Facebook and Twitter and Instagram feeds. So for those who want to participate, there are mechanisms to do that. But we welcome engagement.
Excellent. A lot of information. Bruce, really good conversation. Thank you very much indeed, and all the best with what you're doing, and especially the podcast.
Peter, such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I will put those details, your website, social media, in the show notes for this episode. And you'll find those at our website. That's llamapodcast.com, the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. In social media, we're at Llama Podcast. And you can listen to us on all of the main podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcast. And we're also now available via the streaming service Spotify. Just search for Live Long and Master Aging. And there we are. Many thanks to everyone at TEDMED for helping us with this episode. And thank you for listening. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate your skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexBeam, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code LLAMA at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.